Just to touch on a couple other quick other examples. Newton. So remember, we're talking about the sphere as the image which underlies, has underlain scientific theory. And again, it sounds, well, yeah, so what else is new? But when you hear somebody actually think that way, you realize, this stuff really does grip people. Newton saw, now he's a little bit later, so I think you can see he's working with analogy. The omnipotence, omnipresence of God, top of 59, became the primordial image of a physical field. And the quote we're referring to is Nietzsche, that's a good slip, is Newton saying, I don't know how to pronounce Latin, but the translation would be, like the effective emanation of God. So he sees that circles and God have something to do with each other. More of an analogy, where for Kepler it was not an analogy, it was a physical parallel. Relativity, she refers to, again, at the bottom of that page. Why relativity? What does that have to do with a circle? Because, remember, time and space. For Newton, you had three dimensions of time, up a space, up and down, back and forth, and then forward and backwards. You can locate any spot in this room by giving me three measurements. You go this far this way, go this far this way, and then go this far this way. But with Einstein, there was space one, space two, space three. There was a fourth dimension. That's the length of that space depended on how fast the object was moving. And as things moved faster, they got shorter. Shorter. So that space has to be defined by speed. Space actually shrinks. That's one of Einstein's theories, which is measurable. And so to know how long something is, you have to know how fast it's moving. I know it doesn't make logical sense, but it doesn't make logical sense.
I wonder if that relates to time.
Yeah, well, movement is just time, or distance per time.
Well, I guess the thought occurred to me that, you know, the older I get, the faster time seems to move.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's not just me, it's true.
Could be.
I think we recognize that objects are four-dimensional, not three-dimensional. Then
right.
You can kind of sort of imagine, you know, like this fourth dimension has to do with the velocity of the object.
Yeah.
You know, so
right.
You know, we think of them as being three-dimensional, but
it's really four-dimensional.
Right.
Who knows? There might be more. But,
correct. With 10-dimensional, if you look at
yeah. Here. Right. Anyway, that's a circle. That's how she gets four dimensions as a circle. Again, just to show how these theories have an image, I can, or you could say are embedded in an image.
And so you had said time is just what? The distance of?
Speed is distance per time.
Speed is distance per time?
Yeah, miles per hour.
Oh, okay.
That's speed. So I said I was trying to make it a little more clear by talking about speed, but it's really time. But time and speed are related. Does that make any sense?
Say it again. What's speed per time?
Speed is distance. Per time.
Think of all those math problems where a train is
traveling
fast.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
put in the universe and all of the quirks and things that are going so fast.
So miles per hour, or kilometers per hour.
Speed is distance mile or per hour.
Yeah, or per time, whatever that it could be, you know, whatever it is.
I was never really good in this.
I noticed.
I could never figure this thing out.
Well, you may just have, it takes a certain...
That part of my brain was in another lifetime.
Yeah, I know. I think you either have an aptitude or you don't, you know. I had such a hard time learning this stuff, because this is the way my mind naturally works. And I had to learn the non-linear way of thinking. So I had to go through it the other way. But it might be easier if you just forget what all that stuff. And just I know this. The hard thing to grasp about this is that we think this book is 6 inches long. Say, if I mean, this is a hypothetical situation. If I were traveling past you at half the speed of light, and you put a ruler up to that book, it wouldn't be 6 inches long anymore. It physically changes its length. That's one of Einstein's propositions.
As it moves, or something else moves?
Well, it's always relative to somebody else. If you're stationary, and I'm moving at half the speed of light, this, of course, could happen. But and you could say, oh, I'm going to quick measure this book when Gary goes past half the speed of light. It would no longer be 6 inches.
Even for her?
Just for her. For me, it would be 6 inches. Because, see, it's stationary. But for you...
Oh, she's going to speed of light.
She's standing still. I'm going to speed of light. But I, from my point of view, I'm standing still and she's going the speed of light. Because I'm passing her. So I'm looking at this book. I can't tell whether she's moving or I'm moving. Mm-hmm. I know. This is all Einstein. It's so... reverse to our common thinking. That's what's so hard about it. There's no longer a stationary object anywhere.
So depending on which reference I decide to, you know, choose to, mm-hmm. to measure by, okay.
If I could go by once at the speed of light, half the speed of light, you measure it at least, I don't know, like that, 4 inches maybe, something like that. Literally, you get it. And if I would then drop it off to you on the way, it would be 6 inches. The length physically changes. It's not as if it changes. It physically changes by the relationship of the two people's speed to each other. If somebody's traveling with me, it's still 6 inches. If she's traveling at, let's say, 3/4 the speed of light, and she would measure it, it would be different. It would be 3 inches.
You can mathematically compute all these things, but you don't notice them because we're looking at just the three dimensions.
Yeah.
And that's the difference when you look at quaternity and trinity thinking. So that would be another guy.
So what would the length be? Do you remember that formula?
The mass increases, obviously, as you
mass increases and length decreases.
Right.
You need to figure this out. It's not that hard.
Yeah, not just so simple.
You can.
No, it's not. No, wait a minute. It's the square root.
I'm just thinking subjective.
Of the speed of light, isn't it? The square root of velocity, that's what it is. The square root of the velocity over the square root of the speed of light, I think. That look right?
See, it's wiggling your pencil and it looks like it's curved.
Well, that's a couple of vodkas, I think. No.
Throw in liquor to that.
That's a whole nother issue.
Optical illusion.
Yeah, let's.
That's a whole nother issue.
Wait. Your square root doesn't look like a square root. Is that what you're saying?
No, I was trying to get it so my brain can.
Oh, okay.
So if I'm going length,
I'm just saying it depends on the person.
There you go.
And that kind of
it depends on how fast you're going with respect to each other.
Yeah.
And the two things that are new is length changes, and there's no longer such a thing as a fixed point. And why do we have to think like that? Because we're all standing still. Or we are, the fastest we go is 500 miles an hour. That's nothing, you know, compared to 186,000 miles a second. But when you're going that fast, then, as electrons do, then all this stuff has to be counted in. So as the closer you get to the speed of light between two things, the more it goes from 1 to 0. So if I'm going the speed of light, then this the length in this book would be 0.
Do we really have to move?
Not really.
As Thomas has, but you must know the equation and be able to do the higher math.
But the reason why I got into it, it's a quaternity. And circles are the shapes the psyche uses to express quaternities. So that Einstein's theory is based on a mandala.
Well, it sounds like it uses those to express trinity and quaternity.
No, it's quaternity only.
Well, but
the old physics was trinity.
I think maybe one of the points is that quantum mechanics then can include like the spirit as a quaternity, whereas Newtonian physics can't. You know, so that's one thing you were kind of trying to point out, that that's why we're kind of getting into it, like how does mind and matter interact, is now we have a four-dimensional a quaternity to work with, and Newton didn't have that, so it wasn't even possible as a concept. And there's no ability for the mind to influence matter in Newtonian physics. It just, there's no possibility. But now that we have the sense that there is a quaternity in action, as you approach the speed of light, you can actually see it happening. Like, you can see that all these Newtonian things that we took as absolute no completely fall apart as you approach the speed of light, you know, which again, I assume you think is spirit as, you know, what an infinite speed, then there's a place for the mind to interact with matter. If you think of the mind maybe as operating at infinite speed, all of a sudden the ability of mind to influence matter or matter to change at that speed becomes a possibility.
Is that why you dropped an apple instead of a brick? I'm just being facetious.
It's not that hard, really. The basic ideas aren't hard. The implications... I don't think the implications are hard either. They just require a surrender of all categories.
Well, then if we go on to quantum theory, the quaternity falls apart.
Go ahead.
Because if they find the Higgs boson, which gives matter mass, then that implies the other dimensions. Then we lose our four dimensions.
Could very well be that we will have to give up this paradigm. Mm-hmm. Could very well be.
Yes, the four-dimensional universe is as limited as a three-dimensional universe. Mm-hmm. If there's really a ten-dimensional universe that we're just beginning to understand.
Right, because to understand the weakness of gravity, the weakness of that force, they have to theorize the other dimensions, because otherwise the weakness of that, the other four forces are so strong in comparison to gravity.
To
understand the weakness of gravity, they have to hypothesize the other dimensions.
Right, exactly, because we have no ability to explain how gravity works.
Right, and that's why they call the Higgs boson the God particle.
Right.
Because then that implies something beyond us.
Correct, that we have not yet been able to measure.
Yeah, now I ask you, so why is this important? Because think of the shift from Freud to Jung. That is parallel to the shift from Newton to quantum physics. Jung is as complicated compared to Freud as quantum physics is compared to Newton. quantum physics introduces new factors and makes reality more complicated. For Freud, cause-effect, no longer adequate for Jung, purpose enters in. Cause and effect dies in quantum mechanics because they realize some actions are simply spontaneous. So that physical thinking and the way we see ourselves are actually related, the way we emotionally understand ourselves. Now, who knows where we'll be in 200 years? That's why this is not just gibberish. It is, as science evolves, our mind evolves, and as our mind evolves, we can understand the complexity of our personality with more accuracy. We're never going to get there, us. But we have seen a shift from 3 to 4 in physics. We've seen a shift from 3 to 4 in Jung. And that is our introducing into psychology factors like teleology, purpose, synchronicity. There's no room for that in Freud. There's no room for that in Newton either. But there is in quantum mechanics. So that, I just want to clarify, we're not just out on a tangent here. And going back to the original discussion, all of this is based on a quaternity, which is 4, which is a circle. So that our mind is being, and our view of ourselves is being shaped by this image of a circle, whether we know it or not. Who knows what will shape our mind in 200 years? Why bother? Well, because 200 years ago, our mind worked differently. And these are not absurd considerations when you look at how we've changed over history. And she's just then trying to give us some of the images.
I mean, the circle still held him, right?
The circle held him, but in a different way.
And then maybe the next thing will be, well, there's spheres in relationship to each other right now. We just have to learn.
Could very well be. Yeah. Again, just go back. I don't mind going out from these tangents, but always bring it back so we don't get too confused. Is she's looking at how images are implied in the way we think. Because the old way is we think. And she's saying, no, we think guided by images. We just don't know it. You can see it much more clearly when you look back in the past. I mean,
She was always saying 8 was the complete number, which... So I'm thinking hexagon. You were saying that. I was thinking hexagon as maybe the next. Mm-hmm. But wasn't she was always
saying... Yeah, yeah. Well, I think any multiple of 4. Mm-hmm. And in law, you go into a court of law, it's cause and effect. You can't say, this is the case because I feel it. Mm-hmm. You have to demonstrate fact. Well, that's Newtonian. So law is still in a 3 world. Who knows what it would be like if it would shift to a 4 world? Yeah.
The architect
made me
do it.
Oh, well, you're excused. Okay, well, that's the sort. The next chapter, the next section, particles, elements, and causality, and then she also talks about complementarity. I think I gotta simplify this a little bit. The idea that there is such a thing as a point is itself an archetypal idea, she wants us to realize. As soon as you were talking about these little problems in freshman physics or something. So, the car goes from point A to point B. Well, there's no such thing as a point. That's an abstraction. And that, she's saying, that this idea that there are points in space is an idea that has come from an image.
And it's archetypal, you say?
And that would come from an archetypal image. And that archetypal image, now you probably might not be familiar with this, but certainly in any kind of depth study of alchemy, one of the key terms in alchemy is synthoi. which just means little, sparks. One of the key ways it's symbolized in dreams is stars, little specks of light. And in the alchemical mind, matter has got little teeny bits of light in it. So when they are cooking, let's say, the piece of material, in some recipes they're trying to release all those little points of light or fire in the material, collect it, and then that helps the process turn into gold. Or in the Gnostic tradition, remember when God creates the world, he gets caught in it. In some accounts, he gets caught in the world as teensy little spots of light.
I never really thought about this, but really a point, it's not just a point, but it's what it's the point in. So it's a relationship to what it's in. I guess I didn't really thought about that.
Yeah.
But that's really what these...
That's what these are. And she's just saying, you know, points, which is a basic feature of mechanics, of physics, are derived, that idea that there is such a thing is derived from the scintillae, which are little points of light.
And scientists still measure those points, measure light.
Sure.
You know.
I think we also have this idea that we used to think an atom was, you know, indivisible, like, which is from that primordial image. And then it's the truth is that matter may be infinitely divisible, just as space is. Like, you can't make, you know, the small, there's no smallest increment of length, right? You can always cut it in half and half again and half again. And for infinity, may be true for matter also, that it's infinitely divisible and that there is no ultimate particle, which we've always thought was true. You know, like, and then all of a sudden the particles get smaller and smaller and smaller. And the more you look, the more you find, and it may be that matter is infinitely divisible, which is totally goes against our idea that there is some smallest point of matter. Yeah. You know, that may not be true, but it comes from this primordial image.
Right, it comes from that image. That's the point.
Because as you said, there's like a Hindu, or I forgot what, saying of the world held up by a turtle, held up by a turtle, held up by a turtle.
Correct.
Held up by, Is that point matter or space?
It's an abstraction. It doesn't really exist, except, now this is where we get to the weirdness, if you think we're weird so far. It only exists in our minds.
Seems to be enough.
And so what...
The projection.
Yes.
Yes, exactly.
What about the two-slot experiment?
Okay, you better explain.
Well, particle wave.
Yeah. In the two-slot experiment, photons are shot through two slits. We talked about this.
Yeah, but they don't know it. So not everyone may know.
And they're shot through one at a time.
A single photon.
Yes, a single photon. And they form a series of bands as if a constant beam of light is shown through the slits instead of two stripes, which you would expect. And this wave pattern can only be formed if each photon went through both slits at the same time. That is, it was in two places at once. But if you put detectors by these slits, that phenomenon goes away. So you end up saying that consciousness is an integral part of the world and shapes reality.
So she's talking about the experiment that proved complementarity, that a photon is both a particle and a wave, right? And so depending on the way you looked at it, you could actually demonstrate physically, okay, it's a wave, because it makes this pattern of wavefront on a piece of paper or on an electromagnetic field. And then
even beyond the way you look at it, if you put a machine there.
Correct, but that's an observer. So the machine is a mechanical version of a human. Well, the consciousness created the experiment.
Well, exactly.
So the design of the experiment determines the effect.
Right, so what they're saying is that consciousness is an integral part of the activity of an electron.
Right.
Say that again, consciousness is the what?
An integral part of the activity of matter.
Okay.
This is part of one of your books, right?
I'm not sure.
I read it somewhere, I'm sure it was
The Heart of the Matter, that book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does everyone follow this, or you want me to do a little diagram?
Follow which thought? Which one?
The wave and particle.
Okay.
Because it'll come up again. See if I can. We actually did this in physics in high school. You can.
Gary, would you mind just moving that just a touch to your right?
How many people were confused by high school?
No, I never took it.
Is that okay?
Forward just a little.
Yeah,
that should help.
Right?
You're under your book again.
Thank you. If you can actually try this in a lake, make a little structure in a lake.
A lake?
Yeah, it'll work in a lake.
Mm-hmm.
And get two people who beat the water with their fingers. And so you'll make waves. Okay? You follow me? Mm-hmm. So the waves will travel. And they'll go through the little slits. And when they get over here, they will start to combine. So you'll get little peaks of water that you can see where these waves combine. Now, you can do the same thing at much smaller dimensions with waves of light. With flashlights, say. Well, not flashlights, really, but let's say lasers or something, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You can shoot a beam of light. Imagine you're going way smaller than a lake. And through these little slits, and you will have a bright band there. So that the light waves combine. So the physicists say, you see? Light is a wave. But they can also then shoot the teensiest possible piece of light possible out of a little gun, and you'll get the same thing. You'll get a bright spot here. How can that be? Because it should be hitting here. But apparently, the little piece of light sometimes will decide to go through here and sometimes decide to go here. Does that sound accurate?
Well, what you actually get as a pattern with a peak. So it's a wave that you see.
A wave pattern.
So
yeah, you see that wave pattern, but it's a particle.
Well, you first will see a wave. So if you shine a little photon through, you'll get the interference. Yeah.
And so what it looks like is not just a band, but you'll see when the waves in the lake come together, you see a wave and then there's a peak, like so. So you'll see, it'll be a bunch of different things with a little peak, so that sometimes the wave hits here, sometimes the waves combine, so there's a broad band across there, like more light here and a little less here, so there's a little wave thing where the waves come through and sometimes they hit here and here and here and here and here. So it's a wave coming through, not just a single particle. But if you put your little detector there, as Carol said, so it measures exactly where did that one photon go through, then you get a single band here and a single band here, and that's it. Nothing else. No wave, no interference pattern. Two particles, or one particle choosing at one moment to go through this slit, one moment to go through this slit, but never in between. Never in between. So it either takes door A, boom, makes a pattern, takes door B, boom, makes a pattern, but it doesn't make this complex pattern, which is an interference of waves together. Does that make sense? So this is a wave. Like sometimes a wave's here, 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 here. Here it's a particle. It's either here or here and nowhere else.
So you end up with two stripes.
Two stripes
on the wall.
Instead of a wave front pattern. So this is two waves in, or a wave going through two slits, like your two little waves from the shore, or one wave coming through the shore. If you can just take one wave here, like Gary said, take one person tapping. Sometimes the wave will go through here, sometimes through here, and it makes this complex interference pattern. If you throw a rock, it either lands here or lands here and nowhere else.
And the only thing that's changed is you've applied consciousness.
Correct. The only thing that changed is that you measured where did it land at one instant.
You've got a machine that's observing, or that's your observer, that's
correct.
Your proxy. And that's the only thing that's changed, and yet you've changed the behavior of matter by observing it. So that's...
Now, why are we discussing this?
You've actually changed the outcome. the behavior of...
You change the physical reality is changed because an observer was present.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the observer chose to set up the experiment, like, I'm going to measure this and prove light's a wave. You do the experiment, light's a wave. You have an experimenter that says, I'm going to set up an experiment that proves that light's a particle. You set up the experiment to prove that light's a particle, and light's a particle.
Okay.
So based on the consciousness and intent of the observer, physical reality has completely changed. So you can actually, it's a very simple thing. I mean, it's not a complex experiment. And it actually is true. So the consciousness of the observer changes the outcome of a very concrete physical experiment to be completely different.
And getting back to what Anne was saying, I mean, there's some research that's done that started out with that purpose and intent.
And if you prove that, that's exactly where you're going to get, you know. Like, if that's your intent, again, that's probably what you're going to find.
And then what if you don't have an intent? Like, you just, it's an open-ended research. So let's just find out what happens. What do you think,
you have to have some reason to set up the experiment, and the design of your experiment is going to indicate whatever your bias is, you know, which is whatever, I assume.
Whatever you're unconsciously thinking.
Correct.
Or
whatever image is driving the experiment.
Right. If you're thinking about that as energy and having an effect on that, as a thought being energy.
Right, or if an image is then driving the consciousness, mm-hmm. then the image is going to appear somehow, I assume, in the outcome, I guess, is, you know, what that would maybe demonstrate.
So I can't remember, when they did this, were they expecting this outcome? Were they expecting?
They were totally shocked.
That's what I wanted to get at. I think a lot of times we are surprised. I mean, they are surprised by the outcome, so it's not that the intent was, I knew this was going to be the outcome. They, you know... I'm just wondering if we're over-rationalizing science too much. Well, thinking that people do things and know what the outcomes are going to be, there's often a lot of surprise. I mean, things often don't go at all.
And sometimes you find the opposite out.
Yeah.
We were just discussing that with Harvard was researching into alternative medicine in the 80s with the intent of just proving it. What they did was prove it.
So the intent is not focused on a particular outcome, but the intent is the observance of the matter.
That's how they're
at a point in time.
Yeah. Right. That the way in which it is observed.
Right.
I don't know. I guess how you figure out someone's conscious intent versus unconscious. I guess is where it gets complicated. I suppose.
Well, in your paradigm would still be. And you can still only experiment. If you're driven by a thought
Well, I want to try to bring it back to our main theme. Well,
that's right.
And I'm just trying to think now how. Does the archetype affect this process? That's what's going through my mind.
Well, when it comes into manifestation, maybe we can think of it that way.
Go ahead. I'm lost as you are. So.
Well, I'm just thinking out loud. Perhaps we could look at these two ways of matter as unconscious. Potential and then manifestation.
I think they would, so, yes, that's it. Because we'll talk about waves in a second. Wave and particle are archetypes.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And so our mind can perceive this in either way. What is it? Well, we don't know. It's both. But it could be that's a projection. That in 200 years we'll say, oh no, it's the blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. It could be something else.
It could be something else that we couldn't, Troy couldn't grasp purpose, we can't grasp
blah.
And again, we can get lost in the details, don't worry about them. But the point is how our understanding is based on a emotional predisposition to see. That's what you should come away with if all this stuff, I mean, I've studied this stuff, it sounds like other people have studied this stuff. If you haven't, don't worry. Just be aware how understanding isn't as objective as it seems. Mm-hmm. It is based on a predisposition to understand.
An emotional predisposition. An
emotion, absolutely right. An emotional predisposition to understand. And now, this is a little bit, I'm going off, but you see, this requires you both, you can accept something is A and B at the same time. Now, let's take our collision with Islam. What if we could realize both Christianity and Islam are right? You see how this apparent shift in understanding in physics really is a shift in understanding, period, which our world needs.
So they're both points. We could say that they're both particles. Christianity is a particle and Islam is a particle, and maybe there's a way where they come together.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or Christianity is a particle and Islam is a wave.
Okay.
And the nature of reality is the truth is both. How many people can endure that tension? See, it's not so bad when you say a particle and a wave, mm-hmm. but it is when you say Osama bin Laden and, you know, and...
Bring the emotional aspect then it changes one's ability to see.
And the, you know, the response would probably be, well, that's a contradiction. Yeah, of course it's a contradiction. It doesn't mean it's false. In the old way of looking, contradiction meant false. In the new way of thinking, contradiction means truth. So that's where this goes in its logical conclusion. Yeah.
I kind of wonder, you know, as we're moving into a time where image is more, you know, image and the way of thinking related to image is becoming as important or more important or whatever than the linear way. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that's kind of reflecting this. You know, because an image can, you know, it's like a symbol that can be a lot of different.
I think it is, sure, I think it is.
So those two may be related then.
I think it is, yeah.
And then my question is, not to make things more complicated, but then how does this whole idea of the observer relate to the process of analysis? The importance of the observer in the analytic process?
That is complicated. I think, in principle, that there is no such thing as objectivity.
Okay.
Which, it's a very dangerous statement. You know, I'm sure you heard me give this story. I had a couple I was working with her, and they were in marriage counseling. And the therapist had this point of view that there's no objectivity. There's her point of view, and there's his point of view. That's the way they were going. I knew he was a sadist. Well, one day he punched you in the face. So I called the therapist. I said, now whose point of view is that? See what I mean? I think at the deeper level, we have to have a quaternity point of view, which allows for the relativity of all things. But at some point, there's no point in telling an alcoholic, oh, you know, it's just your fantasy, you drink too much. So, you have to slide between two paradigms.
I guess I was thinking, too, of the effect on the self as being observed by, say, the analyst.
Yeah.
The effect of that observation that can allow the self to kind of manifest its effect on, you know.
I would like to think that in a successful work, kind of a miracle occurs, that the perceiver and the perceived are in harmony. But you don't know. I think the litmus test is what the body's doing. If you're misunderstood, the body will react.
either the analyst body or the analysis body.
Yeah. Okay. Remember that I told you about that asshole therapist I worked with in Zurich for the first year. I was getting more and more upset because I didn't realize, I thought it was my problem, but I didn't realize that he simply was not understanding me. And one day, after an hour, I was just in shock. And next thing you know, I was looking up at a train barreling down on me. My body put me in a position to realize, he's killing you.
Mm-hmm. What you mean in reality?
In reality. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I didn't consciously choose to walk onto a railroad track.
Oh, my God.
But that's what the body does. So it's a question which to which I don't think there's any final answer, but it's something we have to continually ask ourselves. How much of what's going on is the freedom of two selves, or is it one shaping the perception? Is one's perception shaping the process?
It reminds me of when we studied Adler's Living Symbol.
Yeah.
And the difference between a synthetic interpretation versus a
causal, probably.
Reductive.
Yeah.
Thank you. And could you say that if the self is in tune with both the analysis and the analyst, that you would grasp that larger synthetic?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do.
Okay. That might be another way of saying that litmus test.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the green images that I had a while back was a rectangle, and it was red. The intensity was different. I think it was going from a lighter to a darker, and it had all these spots of light in it.
Scintilla.
And
that means what? Possibility. Mm-hmm. Entrapment.
What? No. That's the
contradiction. Well, are you following this at all? I told you this chapter was weird.
Good. Mm-hmm.
Your archetypes evolving,
you think? I think Jung would say no. But he didn't live far into this century. I don't know. I think we're in a huge shift in everything.
Or our new, maybe the question is, are new archetypes being created, being born?
I think he'd say the archetypes are, we'll talk about this next chapter. There's a difference between an archetype and an archetypal image. The archetype is the structure which creates an image. He would say the archetypal structure is the same. The way it manifests in images changes.
So there's always a God archetype, mm-hmm. but there's a different God image.
You could say something must always be centrally important to you. Mm-hmm. That's an archetype. What that central importance is infinite. Yeah.
I always wondered, so we talk a lot about images. Does an image have to be visual, or can an image be, you know, feeling, emotion, or something like that?
I think
that?
Sure can, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Or a body. Mm-hmm. Or a dance. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. On 59, there's a quote by Marcus Pierce, is that? Mm-hmm. Pierce Davis, mm-hmm. husband?
Or son.
Son. We know, therefore, that in one quite essential respect, space is still what it was in the beginning, the all-embracing, in which everything moves and acts. And that kind of gets to, I think, what you guys were saying about the archetype.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that they are all there, all embracing, but
we discover them.
Right. They're moving and acting, and that gets back to the whole relativity thing.
Mm-hmm. The next chapter, which we'll get to someday, picks up this point exactly. She talks about what we're doing, just to give you a quick overview. We've had a definition of projection. We've had a definition, we've had a discussion of projection in religion. Now we're having a discussion of projection in science, which I think is the most obscure part of this book, so don't panic. And I tried to explain to you at the beginning why I felt it's important. You hopefully can find some way into it personally. Then what she'll do in the next chapter is talk about, so what is it that is projected? Collective unconscious. Then she'll go to three chapters on, let's look at images we can find in cultural history to help us understand what the collective unconscious is, and that image is going to be demons. Then the next to last chapter is, what does it mean to withdraw these projections? And then the last chapter is, what do you do with that? That's putting it simply. But we're right in the middle of a very abstract chapter to see how have these projections worked in history. Then we'll talk about how does Jung conceptualize the nature of what is projected, and then we talk about images to help us understand that formulation of what it is that is projected. So we'll talk about archetypes, complexes, collective unconscious after this. We've got to get through this thing.
But you know, to me, this is so relevant because today, we talk about projection. We create all these beings to get farther and farther away from each other. So now arriving, connecting,
That's the first thing I noticed. I don't know if you noticed, when I got back from France, people were walking around there aware of their environment. Mm-hmm. I got back here, everyone has their face in a toy. Mm-hmm. It really hit me square in the face. I was in the country. I saw none of it.
Mm-hmm. In Paris, you do that.
Paris is like New York. You can't. It's not even like France.
Right. But you know, the fact that we are creating more of these things that separate us, mm-hmm. to me, it's just it is so relevant for today and what we're doing.
Well, I hope this can make some sense to you. Then, again, basic idea: we're looking at the images that have shaped our understanding of the physical world, and how they shift over time and what that means to us. And we'll continue doing that for at least another week or so. So,
and then we project onto another universe.
Or we go to different planets. Have a look, have a read through, in case we get done with this chapter next time, have a read through chapter 5. It's not that long. Sorry, chapter 4. Thanks for hanging in there.
Yeah.
So where do we, how far do we get?
59.
Okay.
4 pages?
Yeah.
Or maybe it was 5. Yeah.
No, we got 61.
Oh.
Okay. Have a nice day.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I think this stuff is fascinating.
Well, good.
I don't understand everything about this.
You don't have to, really. Just get the idea how thoughts have been shaped.
Consciousness and
how thoughts have been shaped by images.
So,
that's the point.
Just getting into science is shaped by images and not by absolute facts. And even that, I think, is a fascinating concept. Like, oh my gosh, all these things that sound so massively real, are shaped by images.
Really?
And are
you're trying to find
like,
it's
not like there isn't all this scientific reality.
And you see that when you look back over a period of 50 years, how what was taught to be true is now disregarded.
Yes, and we think,
One 136 for the whole schmear.
75 miles an hour.
Thanks,
and
Jerry
B was doing.
Thanks for your input. We'll find our way to the truth.
All right, just let me know if it gets
a real instructor.
No, it's very, very much appreciated.
Okay,
right.
The relative.
I've forgotten your complexity thing. Well, I'm just waiting for the right
one. Oh my God.
Oh, golly
Molly. I know. It's like,
Well, I know there's some minds around here that really could do that, but my mind doesn't go there. So are we too much of a pain in the ass if we don't get it?
No.
It's really
that's why we're here. That's why we're here.
But that's the thing. I think Jerry and I were discussing one Wednesday when I was here. What it always was in the past is, this is reality, you need to understand this. And I think the paradigm we're building towards is, we all understand a piece of reality, and if we want to understand more pieces, we need to share those realities rather than try and convert people to ours.
Either or. It's yes. That ant, that thing that you said about ants and God, like cunts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that to me is just a really good, you know, we're ants trying to figure all this out.
And we each get a piece of it. But if we can share those pieces, we can get more of it rather than trying to convert everybody to our piece. And that was the paradigm.
Yeah. Which is where Jung's four functions, I think, are so helpful. You know, thinking has so been the god of, you know, the current reality that, you know, to add these other pieces in, you know, which I think people's questions obviously sort of bring, like, how can you get an intuitive grasp of this, or a sensate grasp, or, you know, something like that. Like, and then when you get that aha at, you know, the function that, you know, you are, you know, that gets it, does it for you, you know, like, then you have a sense of, oh, okay, you know, got it.
Yeah.
And then instead of just saying, okay, if you don't get it as a thinking reality, then, you know, you get a D minus, you fall.
Exactly.
You
know? Exactly.
So,
exactly.
That's crazy. Yeah. I mean, that's how we have it.
Well, it's like, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to plug into the way I think, and I guess what you're saying is the way I learn stuff doesn't plug in very well, or I haven't figured out how to do it, whatever. What is your you're just maybe on a different function.
Yeah. But I think you need to stick with your own reality, you know, and kind of grapple with it until it comes to you in the way it comes to you, instead of, you know, like having, I mean, I think we have this default, like, oh, I don't get it, stupid, blah, 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 whatever it is, instead of realizing, okay, this method that it's being presented, you know, isn't coming in to a sense that works very easily for me, you know, sort of, and so everything else is slower than thinking. I mean, all the other functions are slower, so I think you just have to kind of grapple with it and sit in it until it comes to you in the way that it comes to you, and, you know, not have a sense that there's something wrong if the thinking method or whatever maybe is not your thing. I mean, there's nothing wrong
that's
with you.
That's a good thing to remember. Other ones are slower.
And I'm an intuitive. You know, when I live in a scientific world, I've had to kind of figure out that my way is, even though I'm not like the other people that I know, you know, and I can't do it the way the other docs do, it doesn't mean, you know, that's something I grapple with. Like, there's something wrong with the way I approach it.
Right. But once you realize that you are different, If you can get people to appreciate that the differences actually add something.
Correct. That there's a richness.
That there is a richness there. It makes things slower when you have to work with a whole bunch of different people, but the outgrowth of that process is much richer. Then you can...
Yeah, because all of us, like, have all those functions. So, like, everybody gets it at, you know, whatever, all four levels if, you know, everybody's, you know, bringing their piece, you know, their function to play, you know, then everybody can sort of get it at a greater depth, and instead of their comfort level, which is, oh, yeah, I got it, you know, end of story, I totally understand the concept, and, you know, instead of like, oh, wow, there's reverberations going through me at the depth of understanding of this thing that I thought, you know, I kind of knew at a very superficial level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it adds tremendous amount to, you know, some our grasp of, you know, whatever reality may be, which God knows. You know.
Well, even like this group, after discussing, you know, from different angles and different questions, I mean, it seems to me like, you know, it's really, it comes alive for me. I mean, I can read this and on my own, and it's like, you know, but then, like, today it really came alive. And it was like a whole bunch of different, it seemed like, I don't know if we covered the four functions or not within this group.
I don't know either, but
yeah.
We can tell people we're adding pieces from different angles, which I find absolutely fascinating. You know, like what, you know, what you were saying, Anne, like it just adds, you know, so much
richness
to the experience.
Yeah. Well, my thing is probably just this frustration with myself that I want to understand that, and, you know, it's like I can't make my brain fast enough to get it, and then I'm mad at myself.
Well, but I learned this through many courses of physics, which you probably have not.
But the archetype is still relevant in everything.
Correct.
So if your experience is as a wife and mother, how does the archetype of going from waves are waves and particles and are particles and they're just different to actually they're the same? That is relevant in some way to your experience because it's an overarching archetype of the mm-hmm. whole.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Of the whole evolution that we are in from this reality, the quaternity to the or the trinity to the quaternity. There's an overarching and it affects everything. So no matter what your interest is, mm-hmm. you can find a place in it where. It changes.
What's ironic is that has a flavor to me that's feminine, all right? This sort of overarching, like, the, I mean, women, I think it's not women, but feminine nature to be able to say, oh, yeah, like, to hold two things that are contradictory at once. You know, it's a more feminine than masculine concept because the masculine mind is like, see, there's this or that. You know, so it's funny that, like, it's something that you are finding, like, you know, I have trouble understanding it. It's actually, you know, a feminine concept. That, you know, all this mishmash of things, like, are all true at the same time, you know, so I think that the feminine, which has been discounted, actually has the ability to hold the contradiction more easily than the masculine discernment, which separates things. The feminine just says, yep, it's all true, and, you know, like, and can allow for the contradiction. You know, so it's funny that what you have, you know, like I said, if wife and mother is your experience, you know, that sort of feminine angle actually is going to bring something to this that is important, you know, so it's not that but it's different than, you know, like I said, the viewpoint you've held for so long.
And the fact that they're finding these things in science, which was considered, mm-hmm. I mean, that was the point you keep going back to. They're finding this change, this archetypal change, this shift that we're in right now, in science and matter.
Okay. I see. Okay.
Yeah. So it's a single.
I got to review that. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's like if you. That's exactly. So instead of two bands, it's two peaks. So, the mm-hmm. interference,
so
that's the interference.
So there's a probability curve.
Correct. This is an interference pattern.
And that's where complexity theory
interference.
Comes in. It goes from cause and effect to probabilities.
And then this is part. So interference is a wave, and particles are either or.
Right.
This helped me because I was trying to figure out how to explain the things, but now that I have the framework that you're trying to work in, I can explain it better.
Well, when the time's right, I'll say you're up. Thank you.
Thanks, Gary.
Thanks.